This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Beyond the sheer death toll, there are other counts to keep. How many families are going to be forced into displacement as a result of this attack? For how many weeks, months, years? And on top of that, there are things you can't quantify, but that are just as daunting. The trauma children bear, the fear of not knowing where to go to keep them safe, the stress of having to find a place to sleep or enough to eat.
That was Marine Ole Wetz, an advocacy manager for the Norwegian Refugee Council, on the impact of mass killings in Burkina Faso on children. Details coming up. Also, after weeks of speculation, Reuters says Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau is dead. And the UN warns of imminent famine in Ethiopia's Tigray region. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The government in Burkina Faso has declared 3 days of mourning following an attack that left at least 160 people dead late last week on the northern village of Solhan. Henry Wilkins reports on the aftermath.
Laurent Sorgue, the head of the Burkina Faso delegation of the International Committee for the Red Cross, said the organization responded Sunday morning to a request for medical supplies, noting local hospitals are overwhelmed.
Upon request for support by the health authorities in Dori, we sent half a ton of medical support, mainly dressing, medicaments, sets of plaster, syringes and anesthetic, which was really important to be sent with no delay.
Dori is a town in northern Burkina Faso. The attack happened overnight Friday at the village of Solhan, located in the Yaga province in the country's Sahel region. The extent of the carnage is not known because the number of dead and injured continues to rise. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, although analysts say it could be the work of Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. The attack is the deadliest since the conflict between Burkina Faso and armed groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group began in 2015. The violence follows a period of relative calm. Between March 2020 and April 2021, the number of attacks in Burkina Faso fell dramatically. Since the beginning of April, 7 major attacks have come in quick succession. On May 17th, Burkina Faso's foreign minister, Sheriff Sy, visited Sabah, the nearest town to Solhan. He said the situation in Sabah was favourable and that peace had returned to the area. Mahamadou Sawadogo is a Burkinabe security analyst and former military police officer. Sawadogo said one could see this attack as a show of force, a demonstration of power by terrorist armed groups. He said that today they have shown they control the province of Yaga, and particularly the area of Solhan that they have been trying to conquer since 2020. Solhan is also the site of an informal gold mine that terror groups frequently exploit for funding. The military in Burkina Faso is under-resourced and is finding it impossible to provide security in all regions of the country, despite assistance from French and US troops. Lassane Sawadogo is the General Secretary of the Ruling People's Movement for Progress Party and says that, nonetheless, the government will do what it can. He says he has no doubt that at the government level and at the level of the defence and security forces, initiatives will be implemented quickly to put an end to this spiral of insecurity, which is stretching its evil wings on this part of the country. Aside from the number of people killed, the humanitarian aftermath could also be significant. There are already 1.2 million displaced in the country. Marine Olivesi is an advocacy manager for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Ouagadougou.
Beyond the sheer death toll, there are other counts to keep. How many families are going to be forced into displacement as a result of this attack? For how many weeks, months, years? And on top of that, there are things you can't quantify, but that are just as daunting. The trauma children bear, the fear of not knowing where to go to keep them safe, the stress of having to find a place to sleep or enough to eat. That's the kind of fallout we're looking at here.
Apart from a statement on Twitter, the president, Roch Kabore, has yet to speak publicly about the attack. A United Nations spokesperson said Secretary General Antonio Guterres voiced outrage over the killings. The spokesperson cited Guterres as saying the incident underscores the urgent need for the international community to redouble support to member states in the fight against violent extremism and its unacceptable human toll. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
For more than 6 months, fighting has engulfed Ethiopia's Tigray region. The United Nations warns of imminent famine, and there appears to be no end in sight for the conflict. VOA Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief Heather Murdoch is traveling in the region, and International Edition Steve Miller caught up with her in the regional capital of Mekelle after she traveled to Adigrat.
Officially, the Eritrean soldiers are supposedly going to be leaving the region, but they don't appear to be. I can't say, speak for the whole region, but at least in Adigrat, they don't appear to be leaving. What happened yesterday, when we arrived in early afternoon, the markets closed because, and lots of people told us this story that there was an Eritrean soldier in the market, and the local people, in their anger, started throwing rocks and killed the soldier. And then other Eritrean soldiers, as many as 100 or 200, came to the market to retrieve the body of the soldier and were threatening the local people with revenge for the death of their soldier. This is a great example of how people feel in this town. There's a lot of anger, a lot of mistrust. And when local people told that story, you could see them almost not even be able to speak. They were so angry, not about the fact that they're about the Eritrean presence in the city. There was also skirmishes in the area recently, and it's quite tense and very near to a serious battle zone. We also traveled to Housing today, which is one of the worst hit towns in this area, which has been taken over by various forces. I think about 4 or 5 times it's switched hands since last November.
Heather, did they say where their anger is directed? Because this is a war that is being carried out between the Tigray People's Liberation Front, Ethiopian and Eritrean forces, and all sides in the conflict have been accused of committing human rights abuses.
A lot of the anger is directed at the Ethiopian government forces and specifically the Eritrean forces. But one of the points of contention with the Ethiopian government forces, or at least the Ethiopian government, is that it allows Eritrean forces to be in their country. They see the Eritrean forces as threatening, and there's lots of stories of abuses. And while the stories about the Ethiopian government forces, there's also terrible stories about them, and as well as every other group involved in this battle. But on the ground, what we hear every day is anger directed towards the Eritrean forces and blaming the Ethiopian forces for allowing them to be there.
Heather, in your conversations with the people that you're meeting in Tigray, do they have a sense of what the future holds for them? Because this is a conflict that has been raging for over 6 months. Do they see an end in sight?
Really, they don't. People are devastated and angry. One thing I've been so surprised at is how many people speak so frankly to us and are happy to go on camera to say things that are very sensitive and potentially dangerous for them. And we try to mitigate that danger as much as possible because people don't ask for it. And they say, what am I to be afraid of? This war is going to continue. What could possibly happen to me is worse than what's already happened. This region has been at war for decades off and on, and for longer than that, for as long as anyone can remember, there's been conflicts. So people are afraid that this war will continue. There is, of course, people talking about dialogue, but so far both sides have very stark positions, and there's not been a idea presented that is somewhere in between the goals of each side. So while there are people trying to talk about peace talks and dialogue, solid ideas for how to make that happen have not been presented publicly.
That was VOA Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief Heather Murdoch speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. About 36 people were killed and 32 wounded in clashes between members of the Falata and Taisha group in Sudan's South Darfur state, according to state news agency Suna. A resident said the fighting Saturday involved a land dispute in the area of Dafuk. Security has worsened in recent months in Darfur despite a peace deal signed between Sudan's transitional authorities and some rebel groups late last year. A joint United Nations African Union peacekeeping force stopped patrolling on January 1st ahead of its withdrawal, with Sudanese national forces pledging to secure Darfur in its place. A conflict that intensified across Darfur from 2003 mostly subsided, but some 1.5 million people remain displaced, and outbreaks of violence have become more common since last year. Key infrastructure has been failing in South Africa for the past few weeks, disrupting the country's response to the COVID-19 pandemic, causing hardship and inconvenience, and resulting in huge economic losses. With bitterly cold weather and in some cases snow sweeping South Africa, national power company Eskom cut electricity to large parts of the country. At the same time, equipment failure has left some regions without water for weeks. Darren Taylor reports.
Energy consultant Chris Yelland says the government's constant failure to keep the lights on would be a thing of the past if it took a step into the 21st century, as he puts it. It could do this, he says, if it invested in wind, solar and gas electricity generation. Yellen's convinced that the African National Congress, or ANC, government's not doing this because too many of its friends are making a lot of money from coal.
There are many new black-owned companies that have mortgaged their future by buying up old coal assets that the coal majors have been divesting themselves of, because they know very clearly the future of coal and they've been getting out of coal. And the new owners are so heavily mortgaged and invested in this that their entire future depends on this coal-fired power continuing. As I say, there are many vested interests.
Yellen points out that using cleaner, more reliable energy would also shut down a multi-billion dollar industry that trucks coal to power stations.
These are very powerful vested interests that are determined to retain that transportation industry even when there are cheaper ways of doing things and transporting coal by conveyor from a coal mine to the power station.
So once again, say opposition parties, the ANC is proving that its political alliances are far more important than the public's well-being. The ruling party denies this and says it's committed to investing in diverse ways to generate electricity. But, says Yelland, in the absence of a government plan for this, citizens are going to have to start securing their own energy futures.
Everything from a small petrol generator, which is not ideal, to a battery storage system that gets charged when the mains is on and you can discharge it and provide light and power to computers when the power is off, through to a solar PV system on the roof that is used for charging your battery storage system. Of course, it comes with capital cost.
But the vast majority of people in South Africa cannot afford those options. Breakdowns of equipment, such as transformers at electrical substations, also mean that water can't be pumped from reservoirs to residents. Municipal water boards acknowledge they haven't been maintaining infrastructure, which is causing further water supply failures across the country. But Eddie Singo of Rand Water Company in Johannesburg says these will end soon.
And we are hard at it in terms of replacing the infrastructure that we've identified to be old, such as pipes, such as transformers, even increasing our storage capacities using reservoirs. We can assure the public.
But Singo adds that lack of electricity is also partly to blame for the water woes.
The purification and pumping of water is energy intensive. So for us to be able to pump to anyone else, we need Eskom. So we need all of these electricity suppliers to be available so that we can be able to run our pumps.
The multiple infrastructure breakdowns and failures of essential services have many in South Africa asking, what's next? For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Authorities in Cameroon are battling vaccine hesitancy, with only 11% of doses received since April dispensed, most of them due to travel requirements. Cameroon's government and clergy have been struggling to get the public to accept that the vaccines are safe. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
A group of 70 Cameroonian Muslims gathered at the Djongolo government hospital in Yaoundé Friday to be vaccinated against COVID-19. Coordinator of the Council of Imams and Muslim Dignitaries of Cameroon, Musa Umaru, says vaccine hesitancy meant he had to convince the group. He says Cameroon's government asked the clergy to convince their followers that the vaccines could save their lives. Umaru says every religion that puts God first seeks to protect human lives. He says it is both a divine and civic obligation to protect lives by accepting to be vaccinated against the coronavirus. Umaru says the council has asked all imams and Muslim dignitaries in Cameroon to accept to be vaccinated and to encourage all their faithful to be vaccinated. Cameroon health officials say only 75,000 people have been inoculated since April, when the government received 700,000 doses. And most of the doses administered, say officials, went to people who were planning to travel outside of Cameroon, including expatriates. 37-year-old college teacher in Yaoundé, Rigobert Fonbanla, says many Cameroonians don't trust authorities, urging the JAP after a COVID funds scandal and seizure of fakes.
The same government that is asking the people to accept to be vaccinated against COVID-19 is the same government that is investigating the authenticity and origin of the coronavirus vaccine. There is a possibility that corrupt government officials may have imported fake COVID-19 vaccines or produced dubious COVID vaccines. I will wait for investigation announced by the government to be completed before I can decide whether I will be vaccinated or not.
Most of a $335 million International Monetary Fund loan to Cameroon to fight COVID-19 disappeared. Last week, at least 15 ministers were called up at the Supreme State Audit Office to justify their management of the funds. In December, Cameroon announced that its military seized several tons of fake COVID drugs and vaccines from neighboring Nigeria, raising fears that other fakes might be in circulation. Cameroon's health minister, Manaudra Malachi, says the COVID vaccines being used are good quality and recommended by the World Health Organization. He says the vaccines are not obligatory, but will be administered freely to all civilians who want to save their lives from the deadly coronavirus. Malachi says Cameroon's President Paul Biya is very keen to have transparency on all COVID-19 vaccination procedures. He says the state of Cameroon cannot joke with the lives of its citizens. To encourage Cameroonians to get the jab, hospitals in the northwest region in April said they would waive a usual $2 consultation fee. In May, Cameroon's government instructed all its ministers and senior officials to be vaccinated in public. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Islamic State of West African Province, ISWAP, militant groups says the leader of rival Nigerian militant Islamist group, Boko Haram, is dead. The leader of ISWAP, Abu Musab al-Barnawi said in an audio recording released on Sunday that Shekau died on May 18th after detonating an explosive device when he was pursued by ISWAP fighters following a battle. The Nigerian government says it was investigating Abubakar Shekau's alleged death. Dr. Abubakar Sani is a public affairs analyst based in Maiduguri, capital of Borno State, in northeast Nigeria. Sani spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about the implications of Shekau's death. He says the Nigerian military should be well equipped to meet the challenges posed by ISWAP takeover of the Sambisi Forest.
My reaction is this. I was not really surprised or impressed with the death of Abubakar Shekau. I would rather prefer that the man be apprehended alive so that he can be questioned, be interrogated to provide credible intelligence. In any case, when the pioneer leader of the sect, Muhammad Yusuf, was killed, we didn't see any good that came out of it. Rather, we saw the emergence of Shekau and Barnawi and so on and so forth. So the killing of Abubakar Shekau will not in any way solve this very insecurity that we are being confronted with in the Northeast. But that is nemesis. No, they that live by the sword will die by the sword. Be killing people, slaughtering them. You should naturally never expect to die a natural death. So to me, it serves him right. This is what he deserves.
Do you think the remaining Boko Haram fighters will join the Islamic State West African Province militant group, ISWAP, or will they continue to fight government troops?
Initially, most of us thought the soldiers, the fighters, the insurgents, I think that's the proper word to use, that were loyal to Shekau or members of Ajaz, Jama'at al-Ahl al-Sunnah, would voluntarily submit to the ISWAP faction, the Khilafah faction of ISWAP. But from what we are hearing now, most of them refuse to submit. In fact, they are fighting with the ISWAP faction. Understand? They attack some cells of the ISWAP, and I think they even kidnap their women and so on and so forth. So a few of them submitted to the ISWAP faction, and I think it was with their help that they were able to decimate the ranks of Shekau and even kill him. And they pursued him for about 5 days. You know, after the gun battle, he ran for about 5 days. Then when he discovered that he has been boxed into a corner, they demanded that he should, you know, submit to them, you know, pay allegiance. He refused. He killed himself. He committed suicide. My thought was all his soldiers would submit, but this is not the case. So there is still infighting going on between the two sects. That's still notwithstanding. I think the ISWAP people have taken over most of the territories that were hitherto once controlled by Shekau, for example, the Sambisa area. If we allow them to consolidate, you know, their grip over some of these territories, especially the Sambisa, where we have some of these bunkers and facilities that were built by Ibrahim Babangida, the former military president, it's a very good fortress. If they consolidate their grip on that very place, I think it will be very dangerous, because to me, ISWAP where ISWAP are more lethal than the Shekau faction. Let's just hope that the armed forces will swing into action and do the needful. So the issue of fighting with the government, that one is fundamental. They will continue to do that. The issue of them submitting to ISWAP, some of them would submit, but a faction of them will continue to fight to avenge the death of their leader. And that is how it will go on. I don't think we would see a situation whereby just as metamorphosed into ISWAP and, you know, the thing becomes, you know, as one group.
That was Dr. Abubakar Sani, a Maiduguri-based public affairs analyst. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Maiduguri, northeast Nigeria. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyus Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, Thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.